So with that very brief set of technical reminders, I think we're ready to get started. So at this time, I'm going to ask our presentation team to actually take over the visuals and pull up the presentation content. I'm also going to slide this camera angle over to our first speaker, Alexis. Alexis, I'm going to turn the floor to you here in just a moment, as soon as I see those slides are up, which they are. So Alexis, please take it away.
Yay. Thank you so much, Jean. And thank you, everybody, for coming and expressing your excitement in the Q&A. That makes us feel so good. And we really appreciate that you all take the time to join us and hear about some of these positive economic impacts of Superfund redevelopment. I guarantee everybody that we have here today speaking about this just loves this stuff. And I think you'll hear their passion in their presentations and hopefully get inspired to do some of this work yourself. So my name is Alexis Rourke Reyes. I manage the Superfund redevelopment program from the headquarters side in our Washington, D.C. headquarters of EPA. And I have some folks from around the country with me today, my counterparts in some of EPA's 10 regions. So we have Jackie Kondrick. She's the Superfund redevelopment coordinator for EPA Region 3, which is a Mid-Atlantic. It's Delaware, D.C., Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, and seven federally recognized tribes. Then we'll hear from Joe LeMay. He's our Superfund redevelopment coordinator for EPA Region 1, which is New England. We have, Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Vermont, and 10 tribal nations. And then we have a friend from the private sector. We have Dennis Dowdle, who's the president of Madison Properties. And Dennis has done this work out there in the field, and we're excited to have him here today. He works with various stakeholders, including EPA, on one particular project you're going to hear about called the Woburn Landing Project, up in Massachusetts at the Wells GNH Superfund site. Can we go to the next slide? We have a lot to cover today. Great. So we're excited to hear from our presenters. We're going to kick things off really quick just to orient everybody with an overview of our Superfund redevelopment program. And then talk about why is reuse and redevelopment and restoration important, not just for EPA, but for the communities that we serve. Then we'll cover the types of reuse and the impact that it can have on community revitalization and addressing environmental justice, because that's a big priority area for us and for communities around the country. Then we're going to dig in more specifically to the economic impacts. We'll look at like a national picture there, and then hear from our speakers with some great success stories where in the places that they work. We're going to cover a lot. We don't have so much time, but we're at least going to get you some different real-world examples of the economic benefits that you can get excited about. And, we'll let you know how to find out more after that. So, with that said, let's get started. We'll go to the next slide, please. All righty. And actually, the next slide will be great. Thank you. Okay, so I know we have a lot of people here today, many from EPA, many not from EPA, which is really exciting. So we just wanted to orient everybody really quick to what is a Superfund site. So we're going to use that word a lot. And some people are very entrenched in it, and some people it's kind of new. So it's basically referring to a act that was established by Congress called the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation and Liability Act. So it's called CERCLA. And this act authorizes EPA to clean up contaminated sites and requires the parties responsible for the contamination to either perform cleanups or reimburse the government for EPA-led cleanup work. Although it's not always easy to determine liability. So in order to address cases which a responsible party cannot be identified or that they cannot pay, the Congress has established a trust fund, and that's what we call the super fund. That's that trust fund, which later stands around $8.5 billion right now. And it's typically drawn from, taxpayer dollars, which is why it's so important that it's put to good use. And it's so important that redevelopment can kind of further leverage all of that investment. The final thing I'll say about that is, how do sites get on the super fund list? There are a lot of contaminated sites out there, unfortunately. But we use as something called the Hazard Ranking System. And that's a numerical calculation that's based on the actual or potential release of hazardous substances. And if it meets a certain level, and is signed off on the governor, by the governor of a state, to join this list. It joins the NPL. NPL. So you might hear that acronym. That means the National Priorities List. And so not all the sites that we're highlighting today are on the, or actually all the sites that we're highlighting today are on the NPL. But our program also works on other sites that are called removal sites. Those are also really good things for you to consider. There's many more of them, and they're eligible for support from our program and make really great candidates for reuse. Next slide, please. Thanks. So just a little bit more about our program now that we know what Superfund is. Our program's mission is to support EPA staff like Joe, like Jackie, and the communities and partners they work with, like Dennis, in considering future use opportunities and in integrating those reuse options into the cleanup process. So reuse can be explored at any time in the cleanup process. Sometimes these cleanups can be very long, and we encourage that to do to look into reuse early, and especially before decisions about what how the site is going to be cleaned up are made. But if that doesn't happen, that's okay. It's never too late. And you can always kind of access the benefits of our program. Some of the kinds of reuse that are out there, we have over, I think it's over 1,200 sites across the country that we know about are in being reused or continued use right now. So these are some examples. We have health centers, we have homes, we have office parks, industry, community facilities. So again, you're probably guessing EPA does not own these sites. They are not EPA property, and we also do not control local land use. We don't make zoning decisions, or that's up to local government. But what we do find is that our technical assistance and the expertise of, you know, the folks that you have in Superfund site teams out in the regions on every site can really benefit from kind of having these conversations with local stakeholders early to figure out how we can potentially work in their future reuse into our cleanup, or if not, how we can revisit it. So next slide, we'll talk a little bit more about why we do this. So as I hope everybody knows, but maybe not, EPA's mission overall is to protect human health and the environment. And so why is Superfund redevelopment so well aligned with that? Why is it such an important piece of the Superfund program? It really delivers kind of three big buckets of benefits in our mind. One is environmental protection, first and foremost. So it helps us find long-term stewardship and protectiveness for the site and can also leverage benefits for community. It also gives opportunities to be creative about sustainable development and introduce kind of new land uses to, you know, also address issues that might be out there in the community, such as, you know, needs for renewable energy, stormwater management. Actually, in some sites out in the West Coast, even replenishing groundwater and drinking water supplies. So it's a whole gamut. And the other thing is that one of our most precious resources is land. We don't have an unlimited amount of it, and so when we make this effort to reuse land that was previously contaminated, has been cleaned up to be safe, we are preserving green fields, so land that has never been developed through that. And so I think a quick stat is that for every 4.5 acres, for every acre of redevelopment of Superfund site or even a brownfield for that matter, we are protecting 4.5 acres of open undeveloped greenfield land. That's pretty amazing. And then also economic improvements. That's what we're going to talk about a little bit more. But just, you know, some of the things we look at there, we bring jobs, employment, increased taxes for the local governments. Also, sometimes these sites are sitting in places that might, when you redevelop them or reuse them or restore them, it can be a catalyst for other parts of the surrounding area to get changed. And overall, I mentioned a little bit earlier, this helps us leverage our investment. Taxpayers, all of us pay, you know, we pay for this cleanup in many cases. And so what we, this reusing these sites does is really help make sure that those benefits keep on going and those investments keep benefiting everybody that's paid into it. And then, kind of on that note, social equity is really important part of our mission. And this is kind of a process piece for us, not just the final result that is delivered in terms of redevelopment or maybe, community use or something like that, but just our process that we use. We tend to support planning processes where communities that have been living in areas with Superfund sites get to have a voice in the decision making. That's a really important piece of, the how you do that is really important to us as well. I will go to the next slide, please. Just highlight a couple of types of site reuse and let you know that you can go to our web pages and kind of see some of the same typology out there and find all kinds of uses out there and many, many examples. There's no one size fits all. I think that's what keeps people like Joe and Jackie working in this field for so long because it's always exciting. It's always really tailored to what the land, what the cleanup, and what the surrounding community kind of prescribe. And so I think I'll go to the next slide that because I want to make sure that we give enough time for folks. And just a quick note, I mentioned environmental justice, I mentioned social equity. Just wanted to make kind of a finer point on that and just to note that environmental justice and community revitalization and restoration in the case of is really intended to serve the communities that have been exposed to these sites, have been burdened by these sites in many cases for years. And there are a lot of people out there that are in that situation. So about 73 million people, so about one in every four people in the United States tends to live or lives within 3 miles of a Superfund site. And compared to the general population, these people tend to be more low-income people, more indigenous, more people of color, and have had a lot of other environmental stressors and burdens too. And so it's a really important part of our program to kind of be careful about equitable development in the way that these sites, to the extent that we're invited in, and we hope to be able to develop these sites in a way that really delivers benefits that can be enjoyed by those communities, cultural, recreational, ecological spaces, homes, healthcare, retail, services, and then, jobs and income and local tax revenue that goes to pay for all the services that people need. So, with our next slide, please, I want to just share a little bit more. You guys came here today to talk about the econ impacts, right? So we'll go to talk a little bit more about those on the next slide. And just wanted to highlight a couple of the specific effects that we measure. We're really fortunate to be able to keep really close track of this on a number of sites. So some of the indicators that we look at are the number of businesses that are located on a site. And some of these sites are enormous. So that is no easy feat. Then we also look at the number of people that are employed at the businesses on the site. We look at the annual income that's generated. We look at the sales revenue that those businesses are generating. We look at on-site property value and property tax generation. And then sometimes, depending on the site, we can dig in a little bit more and look at other kinds of economic impacts. So if you would like to go to the next slide, please, I will share a little bit more. Hot off the press, we have our 2023 numbers. Again, we do these numbers every year. They usually come out right around this time of year. And I'll just have to point out, first of all, I mentioned that there are over 1,000 sites in reuse, but we don't have economic data for all of those. So, this data that you see here on the screen reflects about almost 700 sites where we really know what's going on there. It's a moving target to try to keep up with all the data and other sites, but even just from those almost 700 sites, the results are pretty amazing, and we're really happy to share those with you. We have over 10,000 businesses operating. We have the sales generated by those businesses totaling $71 billion every year, We have people employed, over 200,000 people, and those people are earning $18 billion in annual income. And so, these are some of the things that we track. We're really excited to share with you and dig in a little bit more in some real world examples. So before we do that, I wanted to highlight one more thing on the next slide and then a video for you. Thanks. Okay. So just to highlight a couple other ways that we share this information, I mentioned that Jackie is from our Mid-Atlantic region, Joe's from a region one. And so, in recognition of all their hard work, we don't want to just deliver them a lump sum national number. We actually do regional economic profiles so that we can see we do it by the regions that, as I mentioned before, those kind of have a group of several states in them, but we also do it by state. And so you can go and access on our webpage the data for your state. You can look more specifically at the number of sites in reuse, number of businesses, employees, all that good stuff. That's on our website. And you can also look at some of our case studies. So sometimes there are one site that is just such a great example that we've been able to kind of dig in and tell you the story of how that went about. And then sometimes we have these case studies that are kind of more topical. So we just put one out a few months ago on ecosystem services benefits and kind of how those play a role economically, of course, and socially and ecologically. So feel free to check those out and let us know if you want to hear more. But the next slide, thanks. Again, we have real folks from the field today. I'm a headquarters person, These are the you don't want to hear from me, you want to hear from them. So we're gonna tie this up here for now. But what I do want to leave you with is one example. We have highlighted Northeast today and Mid-Atlantic with our case studies and our speakers, but this work happens all over the country. I wanted to highlight a site in the Southeast in Charleston, South Carolina, the Coppers Superfund site. It's a 102-acre site. I've been out there. Beautiful. It was a wood treatment facility on 45 acres. And that treatment facility ran for about 40 years, contaminating groundwater, sediment, soil, and surface water. And so it was added to the NPL, National Priorities List, in 1994. And Superfund and EPA, working with the partners and the state, did a great cleanup job, digging up contaminated soil, disposing of it safely, placing a cap over the soil, which is kind of like can be a thick cap of soil, or it could be an actual engineered cap. Rebuilding drainage ditches. This is actually a waterfront, Charleston, South Carolina. If you can imagine it, there's a lot of kind of marshes there, cleaning up all of that and treating the groundwater and monitoring that. And so in 2018, that actually the remedy was updated so that they could use this for residential. And so we were out there, a group of developers decided to kind of really invest there. It's a beautiful, beautiful space. And we have a short video here of one of the partners who's worked on this project and other partners in the Southeast named Gerald Pouncey from a law firm called Morris, Manning and Martin. And I will let him tell you what his perspective is on Superfund redevelopment.
Well, I'm Gerald Pouncey, chairman of Morris, Manning & Martin. We're a large law firm in Atlanta and Washington, D.C. And for the last 35 years, myself and a lot of our team have focused on redeveloping Superfund sites around the country and have probably now been involved in redevelopment of well over 100 of those sites. I can't tell you how rewarding it is see these sites when you first come on and see the blight that they represent. You see the threat to the community, both from a health and, quite frankly, a safety standpoint. And you're able to put teams together that redevelop these sites, clean the sites up as part of that redevelopment, and then have a wonderful working community there to support other communities, to support the region, and to provide both an increased tax base and job opportunities. And so for all of you that are there, please get out and let's continue to redevelop these Superfund sites. Thank you.
Thank you, Gerald. Yes. And so, yeah, I mean, you could see kind of that was the site. And so that's planned for a beautiful waterfront mixed use development. And yeah, there are folks out there again that are really passionate about this on the private side. And we have folks that are really passionate about it on the EPA side, including my friend Jackie Kondrick. I think I'm going to pass it over to her so she can tell you about an example from the Mid-Atlantic.
Thank you, Alexis. Hi, everybody. My name is Jackie Kondrick, and I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator for Region 3. I'm also the new remedial project manager for the former Nansemond Ordnance Depot site. There's a lot of redevelopment going on there at that site, and so we thought it would be a great way to kill two birds with one stone and have me be also the remedial project manager. Let's go to the next slide. So, the former Nansemond Ordnance Depot is a giant site. It's 975 acres in Suffolk, Virginia. It's on the James River at the mouth of the Nansemond River. And the Army constructed the site during World War I and operated it for military purposes through 1960. It was actually known as the Pig Point Ordnance Depot originally from 1917 to 1929. And the Army used the site from 1917 to 1960 primarily to store, recondition, and distribute munitions. Then, after World War II, the Navy used the depot to demobilize from the war effort, and that included decommissioning munitions, which you can see in the photos here. And that really caused a lot of contamination widespread in the soil and groundwater and sediment in the area. So, after 1960, multiple private property transfers took place. There's a lot of private owners now of this formerly used defense site. We have a private military academy, Virginia Electric Power Company, GE was there, the County of Nansemond. And the Tidewater Community College has operated at the former depot since 1968. So, in the 1980s, the explosive TNT was found on campus, and the shoreline erosion exposed munitions on the shoreline. This initiated a series of investigations and removal activities led by the Army Corps of Engineers with oversight from the Virginia Environmental Department of Quality and EPA. So the site inspections found extensive contamination in disposal pits, fill and demolition areas, an on-site landfill, holding tanks, trenches, and an offshore dumping area that extended the low tide line to 1 mile offshore. Several emergency response actions and removal actions were taken to address the immediate threats to human health and the environment. And then the site was listed on the national priority list in 1999 to continue the long-term response action and get the rest of the site cleaned up and ready for beneficial reuse. Next slide, please. So you can see here a map of the former Nansemond Depot. The red outline shows the site boundary, and you can see there's lots of different zoning going on here and lots of different owners. But the main thing I wanted to point out is there's a blue box in the middle there that's outlined that says BCP Suffolk, and that's the area that I'm going to talk to you most about the redevelopment that's taken place. But you can see that there's a lot of room here still for more growth. TCC owns the property at the top in purple, and they're working on some new redevelopment plans, so we're excited to work with them. There's also some residential houses, there's mixed use, there's office space, light industrial, there's really a little bit of everything, and it's just such an exciting site to work on. Next slide, please. So here you can see an aerial of the site. The TCC and the businesses, you can see all right in the middle there. And in the community, about 5,000 people live within half a mile of the site. An estimated 45% of the people living on and near the site are people of color. 7% of the community is classified as low income, a rate lower than the state and national averages. An analysis of the Superfund area was conducted using our environmental justice screening and mapping tool called EJ Screen, and that identifies key factors related to environmental justice and socioeconomic risks. At this site, most of the EJ and socioeconomic risk factors identified by EPA are considered lower risk than the state and the rest of the country. But the proximity to wastewater discharge ranked very high because there is the operation of a wastewater treatment plant on site. But this facility takes concerted measures to ensure the wastewater discharge is properly treated and does not impact the local health or ecology. And we're actually going to talk a little bit more about the exciting plan that they have there to make their process even better. So public involvement at the FNOD site has been going on since 1997, when the Army Corps sponsored the formation of the Restoration Advisory Board, or the RAB, as we call it. Lots of acronyms. We love acronyms. So the RAB includes stakeholders from EPA, Army Corps, Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, the local landowners and business representatives, and the local residents. The purpose of the RAB is to provide a forum for discussion between the government and the community. We have quarterly RAB meetings that are open to the public. They're virtual or hybrid, and this allows the parties to review and participate in the progress of the restoration efforts, share redevelopment ideas, and really just provides that forum between all of us. So the RAB meetings have led to the prioritization of cleanup in which areas first, things like that, to really help the economic redevelopment take place. And we're going to talk more about that now. Next slide. So, as a formerly used defense site with various contaminants, the site had a really complex cleanup coordination with EPA, the federal agencies, and local government. And throughout the process, EPA facilitated community efforts advocating for equitable and protective redevelopment. The Army Corps and the, is the lead agency for the cleanup at the site. And in a partnership with EPA and Virginia, we investigated hundreds of acres, removed 6,200 munitions, 400 of which were considered live, and 200,000 pounds of munitions debris to prepare the site for safe and beneficial reuse. Over 830 acres are available for redevelopment or reuse now. A total of 14 removal actions were completed at high-risk areas, and the investigation and cleanup work has been completed at 12 out of 21 areas. So there's 141 remaining acres that need to still be cleaned up. While cleanup activities continue, redevelopment in recent years has been incentivized and helped redevelop the local economy and brought hundreds of jobs to the FNOD site community. We want to highlight the Road One Intermodal Logistics Facility that's brand new and an award-winning cleanup and redevelopment that was coordinated between multiple agencies. In November 2021, Brookwood Capital Partners broke ground on the 45-acre redevelopment spanning the main burning ground and GE Pond areas of FNOD, which was that little blue square I tried to show on the map a minute ago. So BCP, Brookwood Capital Partners, when they bought the site, they hired Hanna Engineering and consultants to engage with EPA and the Army Corps and stakeholders for the cleanup effort to try to expedite the redevelopment at that site. So EPA issued a comfort letter enabling them to remove contaminated sediment from the pond and main burning ground to construct a larger stormwater system to help facilitate the redevelopment. Around 2,000 tons of contaminated sediment were disposed of off-site, and several hundred cubic yards were reused on-site for grading and building the foundation, things like that. The project allowed for the closure of the pond without the need for additional remediation, and the 338,000 square foot Road One warehouse facility was built over the former running ground, effectively covering it and raising the elevation at the site. So you can see in the slide, that's what it looked like before. Then they built this amazing warehouse. It's effectively a cover, and they did a really great job. Next slide. So while some cleanup efforts are still ongoing. The FNOD includes more than 100 different landowners safely supporting residential, commercial, industrial, public uses, and forward-thinking businesses. I wanted to highlight the Sustainable Water Initiative for Tomorrow, or SWIFT Research Center, which is part of the Hampton Roads Sanitation District Wastewater Treatment Center, where they're actually treating water to potable drinking water standards, injecting it back into the aquifer to recharge the aquifer and deal with land subsidence issues in the area. So really an amazing project that they're working on there, and we're so proud to have that as part of our site. We also have the Ashley Capital Bridgeway Business Center on site, the Lockheed Martin Center for Innovation, the Tidewater Community College for Workforce Solutions, and the award-winning Road One Intermodal Logistics Facility that I just mentioned. So the redevelopment of that Road One facility includes the 338 square foot warehouse that has 81 truck loading docks, 12 acres of trailer parking, and 3,500 square feet of office space. The collaboration and achievements related to redevelopment of the main burning ground area into the successful warehouse facility was celebrated on September 19th, 2023, and received an Excellence in Site Reuse Award. Between the construction and operation of this facility, over 300 jobs have been created. Currently, 34 employees work there with a predicted annual sales of almost $4 million. Future use at the site includes the Point at Harbor View and features 55 acres zoned for mixed-use redevelopment with plans for retail, office, hotel, and residential properties. The College Point and Shoreline Park redevelopment plans to redevelop the shoreline into recreational park and community promenade. We're also looking forward to working with TCC on their redevelopment plans and help to develop their redevelopment vision, really. We do a lot of different services in our redevelopment program, and right now we're working with them to do some redevelopment planning and really help their vision come alive. So we're excited to work with them as they continue on their ventures and see how we can make redevelopment happen there. Next slide, please. So the economic benefits of the FNOD reuse. These businesses, plus multiple projects in place for future redevelopment, contribute to a growing local economy and help generate state and tax revenues. Promoting continued use at FNOD has resulted in economic benefits for the local community, with the number of businesses 34, 895 jobs created, and the annual employment income of over $62 million. Next slide, please. Let's take a minute to watch another short video from our recent Excellence in Site Reuse Award in Suffolk, Virginia. This is Cliff Villa. He's the EPA Office of Land and Emergency Management Deputy Assistant Administrator, and he's going to describe the benefits of Superfund site reuse, including local economic impacts on redevelopment.
Superfund sites are used in so many ways. More than 1,000 of them across the country are home to parks and recreation facilities. They're commercial and industrial hubs, they're education, they're health clinics, they're government offices, they're neighborhoods. Many others reuses play a vital role in local economic redevelopment as well. In addition to creating jobs, providing community amenities, and generating local tax revenue, redevelopment ensures that our cleanups remain protective over the long term. One of the great projects that I got to work on in the West was cleaning up an old railroad right-of-way that had been contaminated for generations, spilled mining waste, and now it's a beautiful recreational trail, and people come to this community that mining had sort of left, and now there's a beautiful recreational trail that brings people back in. And it's so exciting to see the way that our legal authorities can be used to bring communities back together, to connect communities, and make sure that our remedies are safe.
Thanks. Now I'll turn it back over to Joe LeMay.
Thank you, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Joe LeMay. I am a professional engineer in the state of Massachusetts and have been a remedial project manager with redevelopment experience in EPA Region 1 for over 30 years. Since 2016, I'm also EPA Region 1 Superfund Redevelopment Program Coordinator. And I help regional case teams with potential reuse challenges at other Superfund sites in New England. Much of my career has been focused on reducing risks throughout cleanups and transforming properties into a productive reuse. And personally, this is work has been extremely rewarding, where we collaborate with many stakeholders regarding their reuse vision, align them with the cleanup, and safely construct and redevelop the property and help turn that vision into a reality. Next slide. So I wanted to give you a little quick summary of EPA Region 1 economics. EPA continues the decade-long process of making productive, cost-effective cleanup decisions, carrying out those cleanups, and returning New England Superfund sites to productive reuse. There are approximately 93 Superfund sites in reuse and continued use throughout New England. 8 are in Vermont, 11 are in Maine, 13 in New Hampshire, 34 in Massachusetts, 10 in Rhode Island, and 17 in Connecticut. Next slide, please. EPA Region 1 has collected economic data for 604 businesses, government agencies, and civil organizations operating at 41 National Priority List sites or NPL sites. The businesses and organizations at these sites generate about $2.7 billion in estimated annual sales, employ over 10,000 people. Those employees earn almost $900 million in annual employment income. This income injects money into local economies and generates revenue through personal state income taxes. Total property values are estimated at $1.3 billion. Total annual property tax are over $26 million. Region 1 supports numerous different reuses, including municipal police stations and senior centers, multiple recreational activities such as municipal parks, walking, hiking trails, bike paths, alternative energy projects, producing over 155 megawatts of energy, commercial reuse, industrial reuse, hotel and apartment redevelopments, transportation facilities, as reflected in some of the photos that are on this slide. Next slide, please. I'll provide a little background on the cleanup activities at the Wells G&H Superfund site, which is located in Woburn, Massachusetts, and quickly summarize some of the successful reuse projects at three properties within the site. Next slide. This image illustrates the size of the site. It's approximately 330 acres and looks like an upside down triangle. For more than a century, Woburn has been home to many tanneries and other heavy industries. In 1979, contamination was discovered in two of Woburn's municipal drinking water wells, known as Municipal Wells G and H, and these wells were immediately shut down. The wells are highlighted in the figure above in green and located within a valley adjacent to the Abajona River. EPA added the site to the NPL in 1983. The cleanup of the site is currently divided into four operable units, or OUs. OU1 cleanup includes treatment of contaminated soils, excavation, disposal of debris and contaminated soils, extraction and or groundwater treatment of contaminated groundwater at five source area properties as documented in EPA's 1989 record of decision and 1991 explanation of significant difference, or an ESD. Starting at the north on the figure and moving clockwise, these five source area properties are the UniFirst Corporation property, the W.R. Grace Company property, New England Plastics property, Wildwood property, and Olympia property. And many of the OU1 groundwater cleanups continue to operate today. OU2 is a remedial investigation and feasibility study for the remaining portions of the aquifer where this investigation is ongoing. OU3 is focused on surface water and sediments associated with the Abrajona River and wetlands, which flows north to south through the central portion of the site. The OU1 cleanup includes contaminated sediment removal and wetland restoration, as documented in EPA's 2006 record of decision. In 2017, the OU3 cleanup construction was completed. OU4 cleanup addresses soil, sediment, and groundwater contamination at three properties located along the southwest corner of the site, as documented in EPA's 2017 record of decision. The Wells G&H site became more broadly known through a book called Civil Action, written by Jonathan Haar, and a movie starring Jonathan Travolta, which presents eight families' tragic loss of children to leukemia in Woburn and their trial against some of the industries that were operating at the site. Next slide, please. Continuing with the site outline, this photograph of the site shows the three properties that we're going to be discussing in more detail regarding their reuse. The site is appealing for reuse due to its optimal location, which is approximately 12 miles north of Boston and adjacent to two major highways, Interstate 93 running north to south and Interstate 95 running west to east. In 2000, EPA provided a grant to the city of Woburn for a comprehensive land use plan at the site. This was the infancy of EPA's Superfund redevelopment program. The OU1 settling parties also contributed $45,000 towards the land use plan. Over a five-year period, the city of Woburn held many meetings with numerous stakeholders, including property owners, local businesses, the settling parties, community members, and the EPA. In 2005, the land use plan was completed and identified three properties for priority reuse scenarios. The first one, number one, the Abrajona Auto Parts property within the OU4 cleanup location, where the priority reuse was a hockey rink. Number two, the City of Woburn property within OU3 cleanup near the former Municipal Wells G&H, where the priority reuse was passive recreation. And number three, the W.R. Grace property within the OU1 cleanup, where priority reuse was a hotel. Next slide, please. So in this slide, you'll see a few photographs of before and after of the property, the Abrajona Auto Parts property, where the top photo is showing you some former junk cars that were ultimately removed, and the bottom photograph showing the Holland Arena, skating arena. So for number one, the Abrajona Auto Parts property within OU4, The owner and the city of Woburn's 2005 land use plan identified a hockey rink as the priority of the use. At the time, EPA had not yet made an OU4 cleanup decision for the property, but EPA did have a 2004 baseline risk assessment that it prepared, which identified the media with excessive risks. Hence, we call this type of reuse scenario a pre-rod reuse scenario. It is rare, but they do happen, and this is a good example of one. And the greatest risks associated with the contamination on this property were with groundwater and vapor intrusion. 2004, EPA prepared a comfort letter or status letter for the property owner, outlining the current status of the site and recommendations for reuse, including removing all junked cars, preserving monitoring wells, consenting for access, preparing a final reuse design, including soil and groundwater management work plans, and vapor intrusion migration designs. EPA conducted periodic field oversight of the intrusive redevelopment work. And in 2008, the Holland Arena was opened, providing the community with hockey skills and training. The owner of the property is a huge supporter of the Collegiate Hockey Northeast, including BC, BU, Northeastern, and other universities. Next slide, please. So on this slide, you'll see more before and after photographs. The top photograph is a before photo illustrating the various types of debris piles and construction waste that had to be removed within the floodplain. And the after is what we're going to talk about, the Abadrilla Nature Trail. So this is number two, the city of Woburn property, situated within the floodplain next to the Abadrilla River and near the municipal wells G&H. The 2005 city land use plan identified the priority reuse as passive recreation at the property, but under the condition that reuse be pursued after EPA had completed OU3 sediment cleanup. That sediment cleanup required contaminated sediments to be removed and the wetlands to be restored. Hence, the reuse scenario is called post-record of decision remedy, where the remedial design and the remedial action incorporated the passive recreational reuse. In 2017, the OU3 sediment cleanup was completed and included sediment removal, wetland restoration, fill and debris removal from the floodplain, satisfying mitigation requirements and floodplain restoration. Creation of the Abadrilla Nature Trail, including a parking area, kiosk, and various educational stations. The Nature Trail serves as an oasis surrounded by commercial areas that the community enjoys and employees walk during lunch breaks. Next slide, please. So this is the third property, the W.R. Grace property. The photographs here are similarly showing you sort of before and after photographs of the redevelopment. Since the early 2000s, the W.R. Grace was interested in selling, releasing their property, and contributed to the 2005 city land use plan, which identified their reuse priority as a hotel space. In 2006, W.R. Grace demolished their former manufacturing building with EPA's oversight. This created a vacant lot, which made the property more attractive to market. One issue with the reuse of the property was maintaining and protecting the active pump and treat groundwater system. The small aerial insert above generally illustrates in orange the pump and treat extraction line extending along the southern, western, and northern perimeter into the center of the property and terminating to the east at the groundwater treatment building. So the developer had to work around this system. In 2014, EPA provided Madison Properties, the prospective purchaser, a comfort letter outlining the current status of the site and recommendations for reuse, including ownership change, acknowledging to them that the ownership change did not alter W.R. Grace's responsibilities under the 1991 consent decree with EPA. They had to protect the pump and treat remedy. They had to prepare soil and groundwater management plans and health and safety plans. The approved work plan helped prepare the contractor for expected and unexpected environmental conditions and minimize potential future delays with the construction schedule. Vapor mitigation systems had to be designed and approved by the agency to protect all occupied spaces. Through the cooperation of many stakeholders, the OU1 W.R. Grace property was transformed into a productive reuse for the community known as Woburn Landing. The reuse includes restaurants such as 110 Grill and Chick-fil-A and a Homewood Suites and Hampton Inn hotels. I'd like to introduce the Woburn Landing owner and developer, Dennis Dowdle, president of Madison Properties. Dennis and I worked together throughout this redevelopment process, and he will provide you his perspective on the Woburn Landing development and construction on a Superfund site. Thank you. And next slide. Dennis, it's all yours.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe. Hello, everyone. Happy to be here and talk about the Woburn Landing. If you want to go to the next slide, you'll be able to see the similar slide to what Joe showed earlier, just of the Superfund site and where the W.R. Grace site that we acquired in 2014 sits in there. The next slide shows where the W.R. Grace site is from an aerial perspective. As Joe mentioned, the two major highways that run, one north-south, one east-west, each of those highways, or repeat, each of those highways carry 200,000 cars a day. So the location of this site proximate to those two highways was very attractive to us. You can see the general area is a vibrant commercial area. On the north side of the highway, there's a mall, there's a Lowe's Home Improvement Center, another half mile up the road, there's a Target. So there's retail, there's office, there's residential. So there's a lot of economic activity. And this site sat unused for a while a lot of the site cleanup issues were negotiated and undertaken. The next slide is a bit of a closer in look at the site, where you can see the site obviously highlighted there. In the lower right portion of the site, the white building there is the pump and treat. Houses the pump and treat system that Joe mentioned. For the most part, the groundwater goes from the top right of the site to the lower left part of the site. And along that property line, it's gathered and piped up to the treatment facility and discharged out to the wetlands in the back. And that pump and treat system has been going on for since the 80s, I think, Joe, if I'm not mistaken. So it's been going on, and it's achieved great results. And they're in the process of analyzing at what point it can be shut down. The next slide will show you Joe talked about working around the infrastructure that was there. You can see in this slide, every little line every that is noted is either a recovery well or a monitoring well or part of the piping system to the pump and treat facility. So to work around it was no small feat, but in many meetings with EPA and with Joe, we came up with we looked at this plan and then we devised what we thought was a reasonable plan for redevelopment that you'll see on the next slide. And that was for the dual branded hotel. And this is the plan we came up with in 2014, which is essentially what we executed on. So we came up with a plan we thought could work around the infrastructure, the dual branded hotel, Hampton Inn Homewood Suites, a Chick-fil-A, a 110 grill, a Starbucks will open this year. And then it was a Red Robin originally, now will be a Press Cafe, which is kind of like a local version of Panera Bread. So the next slide shows you that this plan overlaid with all that infrastructure. And so after a lot of conversations with the EPA and our consultants about which of the all that infrastructure needed to stay and which could be taken offline. And so we worked long and hard to come up with this plan where everything highlighted in green or blue was infrastructure that was critical and needed to stay. Everything highlighted in yellow could be removed or replaced or relocated. A specific note, in the lower left portion of our site, there's a restaurant building that ultimately became the Red Robin. And there was two wells right in the middle of that footprint that that we were able to get EPA's approval to discontinue those wells. They hadn't been very active, but that's one example of some flexibility on EPA's part to allow that those two wells to be discontinued and allowed that particular restaurant building to be built. Next slide, please. So as we got closer to construction, we worked with a consultant, Sanborn Head, who was with us from the beginning on this project and did a great job representing our interest in getting us to a point with EPA that we could all move forward comfortably. So we came up with the soil groundwater management plan, and it was to allow the EPA to review our plans on how we're going to develop the site. And equally important, it allowed us to avoid the in the off chance something happened out there where we found something or something didn't look right. We could always refer back to this plan, and we did. And so instead of calling up the EPA and saying, oh, we found this, what do? It was, we found this, and this is what we did, and we're going to continue working. And we've isolated the situation per the groundwater management plan. And it gave both sides a lot of comfort that there was a plan in place for the foreseeable and the unforeseeable. And it was, it worked out great. And that plan still exists today and still governs the redevelopment and the reuse of the property and the tenants that are on the property. The next plan shows our construction starting. And when we did construction, we had perimeter dust monitoring. All the on-site personnel had PID meters on their on them at all times. So it was very heavily monitored. There was a lot of oversight from both EPA and our consultants to make sure that everything was done in accordance with the soil groundwater management plan. The next slide shows the opening of the Red Robin. That was where those two wells that we were able to discontinue were located. This opened at the end of 2016. So this was going into 2017 timeframe. And Red Robin opened. And you, one thing to notice in this aerial is the roadway out front. If you look at the when we bought the site, there was Washington Street, which runs in front of the property. It was, you know, very congested, and there was concern about traffic. So we worked with the city and the state to come up with a traffic mitigation plan for our development plan. And if you see the next slide, and you can see the difference in and that the offsite mitigation that we did. Obviously the restaurants create a lot of traffic, and so it was quite a substantial undertaking to widen that road. And it was the one chance the city had, because we had so much frontage that was required to do the widening, because we were spearheading the mitigation. It really worked for everyone, and the city's been thrilled with the result of the traffic improvements. Around the time this aerial was taken, the hotel was under construction, as you can see. And during our construction meetings, which we always invited the EPA and the consultants to attend anytime they wanted, Joe LeMay came to a meeting. It was right at the end of the point where we were doing any intrusive digging into the soil. So everything was either bindered or built upon. So if you look at the next slide, at the end of our meeting, one rainy Tuesday morning, Joe excused himself to go out to his car and bring back these two cakes as a thank you, a congratulations, a celebration of many years of work by a lot of people to get the site to where he didn't lose sleep anymore about maybe finding something under the ground there. So it was a fun moment that everyone on the team was very appreciative of Joe's kindness, and it was a fun day. It's kind of like the scene in Shawshank Redemption when the prisoners were drinking beer on the roof on a Monday morning. That was kind of how we were eating cake early in the morning. So a fun portion of the of our interaction with Joe and the EPA. And the next slide shows an aerial of what the project is today. The hotel's been doing well. The Chick-fil-A has been doing very, very well. And so it's been a very popular spot for the restaurants and the hotel. The next slide will show the economic impact in Woburn. They tax the real estate. They have a meals tax. They have a hotel occupancy tax. This year, the real estate taxes come to $483,000. The meals tax comes to just under $200,000. And the hotel tax comes to over $600,000. Now, this is just the taxes generated for the city of Woburn. It doesn't include any payroll taxes or other job creation elements to it, but it's over $1.3 million annually, which is not why we got involved with this in terms of economic, but it is nice to see that it's a successful project and it has given back to the community and will continue to do so for many years. We would not have been able to undertake it if we didn't have a willing partner in the EPA in terms of we never got everything we wanted, but with the things we didn't get, we always had a reason from the EPA for not being able to do it. But we more often than not had a can-do attitude, and we're able to work with EPA to get this this exciting project complete and up and open and productive. With that, I'll turn it back to Gene coming back in.
Actually, we're going to bring Alexis back to do a couple of quick reminders.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dennis. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Jackie. I hope everybody is kind of getting the full gamut of what is possible out there. And we have some great questions coming in the chat. So I want to wrap up really quickly so that we have time to take some of those. So let's go to the next slide, please. Okay, so we have a ton of tools out there. We didn't get to talk much about these because we really wanted to focus on the case studies, but we're really fortunate that we have a lot to offer you. We have technical assistance, but in addition to that, we have so many examples out there. We have mapping products. We have trainings that we develop. We have all kinds of kind of tip sheets and fact sheets out there. So please take a look at our website. and see what's out there. And if you see something that you have a question about, please don't hesitate to reach out. If we go to the next slide, I will show you who to reach out to. So you can always reach out to me. You know me, especially if you mentioned that you were on this webinar. Oh my, forget it. Yeah, no, but we're happy to hear from you at headquarters. And then we also have in all of the EPA 10 regional offices, we have coordinators there. So you know Jackie, you know Joe. And if your region here, we have a map here. You can find out also on our website. If you go under regional redevelopment contacts, you will be able to see who's there in your region. They will probably be your best first point of contact because they know all those sites and know the people that actually manage them. But either way, we're happy to hear from you. Next slide, please. Thank you. And yeah, again, here are some kind of key links for you. We hope you'll join our mailing list. We do these webinars a couple times a year. And we also send out, you know, reports and updates when things are available. And so we hope you'll join our mailing list. Next slide, please. And yeah, now we'll take some questions and make sure we have time to thank our presenters again. I don't know, Jean, if do you want to tee some of these up for everybody?
Yeah, right. I think I do. Yeah. And what I'll kindly ask all of my presenters, if you all could come back on camera, I'm going to make sure that everyone can see all of you because it looks like we do have questions that may be directed at a number of you today. And so as I'm doing this, just making sure we've got all of our speakers here on video, I do want to remind the audience, you can continue to share your questions and comments for our speakers in that Q&A space. And with that gentle reminder, let's get started with this first question. Alexis, I'm going to direct this one towards you. One of the attendees asked, if EPA is sort of walking the talk, if you will, is EPA making use of these properties for its own sites? For example, are there EPA buildings cited on these types of properties?
That's a great question. EPA doesn't, we tend to use a lot of buildings that are operated by the General Services Administration, but we have some examples there. I mean, we have a lab in Region 10, which is the Pacific Northwest, actually, that is you know, their lab for all kinds of other things that EPA does. And they're on a Superfund site and adjacent to the site. They want to look at developing renewable energy on that site to power the lab. So we don't have a ton of examples because that's not really what we tend to do. We don't have a big physical footprint out there. We kind of deploy to where the issues are, but you know, we're always trying. And that, yeah, it's a very mission-driven and passionate people here. So yeah, I think we try. Thanks.
Okay. And I think one more question that I'll send to you, Alexis, mm-hmm. Is there a public list of all of these Superfund development opportunities?
Yeah, we have this kind of information in a couple different places. I think the first place that I would point you for the most comprehensive picture of it is something called the Superfund Redevelopment Mapper. And it's just like it sounds, it's a mapping tool, and you can kind of do a filter on there for sites, all kinds of different filters you can apply, you know, by what part of the country you're looking in, by size. You can also filter for if it's in reuse or not in reuse. I wouldn't let that be your only criteria, because sometimes it might be partially in reuse and not the whole thing. And as you heard from everybody, these sites can be enormous. So, you know, always feel free to reach out to your redevelopment contacts with questions about a specific site or reach out to us. We also have a piece of our webpage. I hope somebody will put it in the chat publicly. It's for Superfund redevelopment opportunities. There is a handful of sites there. And then the final thing I'll say in that is we are also, you know, we're really interested in that and trying to come up with a shorter list of sites that might be available that we can kind of zero in on, making sure that people know about them. And so we're creating kind of a data set around that now, and we're going to be able to find out and share a little bit more about that in the future. But for now, look at the webpage and look at the mapper, and then just, you know, go feel free to reach out to the person in your respective region to kind of fact check that and get more information.
Okay. Excellent. And just for the audience's general awareness, while you can't send messages in the chat, we can send things to you. So we have been diligently passing some of these links to the tools and the mapper and the property lists and fact sheets in that chat. So if you haven't opened the chat up to look for some of those links, I encourage you to do so. I will also point you to a webpage where you can access these at the very end. So I just wanted to thank everybody for chiming in. And now let's turn to a few questions that are starting to come in for you, Dennis. A number of people have asked about your perspective as the developer. One of the attendees wanted to know, how was it working with EPA during the overall process versus what you might usually encounter when you're working with a municipality, their consultants, or utility companies? Others have asked if you felt you were involved early enough. Do you wish you would have had more input at an earlier part of the process?
Well, one of the reasons what attracted me to the site is when I look at, there's so much data out there, right? With all the annual reports and the 5-year reports. And I looked at the data and I know that the cleanup standards was basically getting it to drinking water. And so much work had been done by the time W.R. Grace was ready to sell the property to us, that it was really, the work was mostly below grade. And the pump and treat was below grade and the soil was, had been extensively tested. Obviously, you never know for sure until you turn over every piece of dirt, which we ultimately did on the property. But so I felt comfortable knowing that a lot of work had gone into the property before we got involved. We did a lot of, we were there early enough because before we decided to buy the site, we met with EPA several times and talked with Joe about some of that infrastructure that would need to stay and what our limitations might be in developing it. That first look at all the monitoring wells and recovery wells is a little daunting. So the fact that we're able to fashion a viable development around them that was well received by the EPA, it helped. And then in terms of the ongoing site work and the development of the site, it was no different than anywhere else because we had that plan in place that we had done up front, so that helped too. So it was really not that much different than a normal site development in the end.
Okay. And Dennis, just quickly, are you planning to do more of these projects?
Once I get over this one.
All right.
I was most interested in the real estate. We've done other, not Superfund sites. We've done some brownfield redevelopments out in Worcester, one of which is the home to the Red Sox AAA ball club and the Polar Park field and about 20 acres of development around it. So this experience certainly emboldened us to take on a downtown Worcester brownfield site. So it certainly helped. And I'll probably go back and see the inventory of the different NPL sites and see if there's any that might be of interest.
Okay. All right. And I did want to just chime in that we have a number of colleagues who are on the line joining us from other programs, and federal facility staff joined us, and they also pulled together a reference about reuse examples on federal facilities properties. So we've shared that link in the chat with everyone as well. So I want to thank them for sharing that and just point everybody to that. I'm going to turn next over to Joe and Jackie. And so, Joe and Jackie, the same question was posed to both of you. As RPMs, did this add workload? They're just wondering, how much longer did your work on the site take because of the redevelopment component? And Joe or Jacqueline, I'm looking at you both. Who wants to go first?
I'll start, I guess. Of course, it adds work. There's a lot of meetings that you have to have with people. And to be honest with you, sometimes these things don't turn out well. Sometimes the development never goes forward and you're expending a lot of time and resources of your own associated with protecting the remedy and ensuring the public remains protective and trying to also find a safe way to reuse the property. This is all part of our job. This is all part of our, when we're looking at a Superfund site, we're evaluating the cleanup of it. We're evaluating what those future uses of the property are going to be. We establish cleanup standards for those future uses. And when future use opportunities come around, it's an opportunity that the agency needs to capitalize on because We've already gone over some of the economic numbers. I mean, these economic numbers are incredible when you think about it. I generally, someone was telling me before, with the amount of billions of dollars that are generated from businesses, if you look at, you know, 1 year's of revenue, that is 1 year's of revenue is, you know, four times the amount of the entire Superfund budget since its existence. And that's incredible. That's 1 year of economics to a community, to a municipality, bringing back these properties to a use that the community's proud of, can use again, go to a restaurant, go to a park, go to a walking trail. So I've been doing this for a long time, and I have saw this vision. I saw this need 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and I'm very passionate in trying to make these things happen where they can align with the remedy. And if they fall through, they fall through. But I will say that a majority of the projects I have worked on, you know, at least 80% of them to 90% of them have landed. And it's great to see the transformation of a property that people can use, especially at a site like Wells G&H that has had such a tragic, you know, history to it. And I know for a fact that community members have approached me and have been just in awe that we've been able to do this transformation. So I will pass it on to Jackie.
Yeah, I really would just echo all of those ideas. To me, it's really been an honor to be part of it. And so I don't really look at it as extra work. Like Joe said, it's kind of just part of our job to me. I mean, we clean up these sites, yes, to be protective of human health and the environment, but the main goal isn't to clean it up and then have a fence around it forever. In my mind, it's like the whole big picture vision is protecting the environment and human health so that the site can still be reused again. So it really is just part of our work. And when people reach out about this kind of stuff, I get excited. So it doesn't feel like extra work to me. It feels like something cool and dynamic, and I get to interact with the community and with different stakeholders who are interested in these sites and really just try to help them make their vision come alive. And I'm like a big picture kind of person, so that's exciting to me. So that's why I've really been drawn to this program and really enjoyed working for it. And so, yeah, maybe at certain times it increases your workload, but anything like that can happen during these projects. These Superfund projects are just so nuanced and there's always something happening. So to me, I'm like, this is a good thing happening and I don't mind working on it. And really, I think it's part of our work. So thanks.
Excellent.
We are so lucky to have these people. Thank you. We all are.
Alexis, I think I'm going to take a general question, but I'm going to pose it to Joe and Jackie. And then Alexis, if you want to chime in as well. Sure. I've seen this theme come up in past redevelopment webinars. One of our attendees just thanked you for your presentation, and they really appreciated all the benefits that you were able to highlight from the community projects, and they really found it inspiring. They asked a question, because NPL sites are designated based on evidence of extensive contamination and risk to human health, they can basically imagine that there must be skepticism around re-inhabiting these areas even after you remediate them. So they were wondering if you could talk about how frequently you encounter tension, reluctance, or perhaps even resistance to accessing the properties after cleanup, and how do you address those when you're working through this redevelopment process?
Okay. Well, I would, in my experience, I would say the greatest fears that are provided by the community or the public is usually early on in the process when you have a new listing, you have initial work being implemented, you're documenting risks. They're seeing you out there you're kind of new over the, you know, the first, I'll use Superfund terms, first 5 years or so, I think is where you get the greatest fears and questions that come up. Once you have been out on the site for the agency's been engaged for a period of time, I believe that my experience is that a lot of that does subside because they become more knowledgeable. And when you're getting into the point of you're going through construction, you may be establishing some type of remedy out on site, whether it's a cap or a groundwater treatment system, you know, the community stays engaged. They're the public, we inform the public with every step of the cleanup. And if there are opportunities to reuse and redevelop, I find that the community is already informed, and like the example I gave you with the Abbott, with the city of Woburn's property along the river, they knew that EPA was investigating the river. They knew that there were risks there, and they also knew that they wanted to reuse their property for something recreational for the community, but they were adamant that that reuse consideration not occur until after the cleanup had been completed. So they were just informed, and they wanted us to be aware and that the community wasn't interested in using it as recreational reuse until after the cleanup was implemented. So that's my initial response to it. Jackie, how about you? Do you have some thoughts on?
Yeah, I've experienced some resistance to certain ideas. And so really just keeping close contact with the community and having public meetings or like open information sessions, workshops, things like that. And these are all things that we offer through our program too, like having community workshops and things to kind of hash out ideas, understand concerns, and really kind of work through them. But sometimes, yeah, people just are resistant to certain things, especially like recreation or residential. They just don't feel that it's appropriate. Sometimes it's a political thing that I've also seen, you know, the communities, you know, city council and things like that are very resistant. And so it's not even necessarily the public. It was really the council that was so resistant. And that I found was a little bit more challenging to handle than the community. I think the community, like Joe was saying, it was kind of easier to build that trust with them and really keep them informed and work things out with them. But when you run into issues with municipalities and government, you know, political things, that's actually where I found it got a little bit more tricky. But I've gotten some great feedback, and generally these things are well accepted as long as they're informed, like Joe's saying, you keep them, you know, in the know about exactly what's happening and make them feel more comfortable, keep in close contact. And I think we've had some great success with these kinds of projects.
And I will add one piece just to flag for everybody. Joe and Jackie were mentioning, you know, all the kind of public outreach that happens. Every Superfund site, in addition to being assigned a remedial project manager, also has a community involvement coordinator. Mm-hmm. And so they work hand in hand to do that. And that's, you know, mandated by the law, the CERCLA Act, to do certain things in terms of community involvement. And that's a good thing. And I would say that I think, you know, for any hesitation out there, you're in good hands if your site is being monitored by EPA. These sites are monitored every 5 years. Full report is conducted on them for perpetuity. And so it's actually, you know, it's a good place to be in terms of knowing what's out there as opposed to not knowing. And you have great, you know, really dedicated people out there all over the country doing this. I know we have maybe time for one or two more questions.
Yeah, we're going to sneak in just a couple of quick ones here. Thanks. I will just acknowledge there are a number of other questions in there. Alexis, your presentation on some of the new information from the report. Lots of people have questions about that data and more analysis. And there's some other topics in here. Maybe a new webinar or two might come out of them. So I wanted to let you know we will be passing questions on to our organizers after the webinar as well. But let's take two quick ones here before we go through our final reminders. One of the attendees wanted to know if there were resources for planning and developing on sites with a containment cap in place?
Yes. Thanks. I'll go ahead and take that to make it quick. We have a resource out there. I don't think it's been in the we can put it into the chat, but it talks about examples of capped area reuses from around the country, recent trends, key factors, and other considerations that make doing this safely possible. Yes, certainly resources on that. And we will put that in the chat for you.
Excellent.
I just want to add something to that really quickly, that through our program, we do offer planning services. So even though we do have examples, if you reach out to your Superfund redevelopment coordinator in your region and you have a capped site in mind, we could talk through hopefully getting you set up with some individual redevelopment planning for that specific site and kind of looking into, you know, more site specific details, actual planning.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then real quickly, what about incentives like tax cuts for prospective developers to develop these properties? Can we direct them so that we might help potentially pull in their interest?
EPA does not get involved in that department. What we do provide is kind of comfort and information around the liability that people would have to consider and what the facts of the project are. Joe mentioned, I think was the first mentioned, something called a comfort letter that is issued that can kind of just illustrate, instead of reading a whole thick report, kind of the clear facts of about the site and the cleanup and what is known and, you know, what the liability issues are out there, if there are liens on the property and things like that. And that is kind of as far as we can go. We don't really get involved in those kinds of negotiations, our attorneys don't, but we do have resources. There's a good one developed by our attorneys called Top 10 Questions to Ask Would Before Buying a Superfund Site online. And I would definitely take a look at that. And then everything else is kind of local, but.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I do see a resource as well that we're going to throw into that chat on top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site, as these are some of the common ones that I think you've encountered. So I'm going to put that one out there. And I think we are just past our scheduled end time, so we may have to cut the Q&A period here, but I'll remind everybody, we do have contact information shown on this slide. Alexis, any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before I take over and do our closeout procedures?
No, just thank you, Jean, for hosting us. And thank you, Joe and Dennis and Jackie. We love having you. And we appreciate you guys so much taking the time out of your schedules to share this with us. And thank you, everybody who joined. We appreciate it. And if you missed it, we're happy for you to be watching it on the recorded version. And please do reach out. We're real people and we really want to hear from you. So thanks so much.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much. I do want to echo Alexis's thanks to all of our organizers and presenters and the support staff who have been on in the background. And I also want to thank the over 220 attendees who joined us live for our broadcast today. I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org, where we collect a whole bunch of resources related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup. As well, I hope you're signed up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, which will highlight free online training opportunities such as today's session. Now, before I let everyone go for the day, I want to walk through a couple of quick reminders. Again, if you weren't here in the beginning, I'll just remind everyone there is a unique seminar homepage. That URL is shown in red at the top of this slide. That seminar homepage will be active from today forward, and it's where you can access information about our speakers, download copies of their presentation materials, as well as access those numerous links that we were putting in the presentation chat in today's live event. We've also posted the links to those resources on the seminar homepage here. So again, that page can be bookmarked. It's the same page you went when you signed up. It's the same page we sent you to in your reminder emails for the webinar. And it's the same page I'll send you in a follow-up email regarding the archive. I'll also ask you to take just a brief moment and visit that page to access our feedback form. Again, you may need to scroll up or down on the page to find it, or use the plus and minus icons on the right to expand or collapse to jump to the feedback form section. But for those of you looking for copies or want to print out a participation certificate, you'll get one of those after you submit feedback for today. Session. So again, visit the seminar homepage, scroll down to the feedback form section, fill that out, and then check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire broadcast. As soon as you send in your feedback, you'll then have access to download or print out a participation certificate for your own record. We will also email a copy of that to you, but sometimes those get blocked by junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it right from that post submission confirmation screen. And if you hosted a viewing party at your location and there were others who joined, if you share the seminar homepage URL with everyone who is with you, they can fill out that feedback form on their own, even though they maybe didn't register on their own, and they can get their own participation certificate based on joining you for that session. As Alexis noted, today's session was recorded. You will automatically get an email when that archive session is available. It usually takes us about a week. And from there, you'll be able to share that with other colleagues who you think will find this of use. And guess what? If you happen to be one of the lucky people watching the recorded versions, right about now in the archived version above my head in the upper right, there should be a button to the feedback form. There's also a button to the homepage, again, collecting all of these resources. You can actually click the button to the online feedback form and fill that out based on your replay of the archived version. And then again, check the box at the bottom and get a certificate based on the replay of the archive session. So with that, a great big thank you to all of our speakers, all of our organizers, and each one of you for joining us and participating in today's session. We hope that you found this to be a valuable experience and you'll join us on a future seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.